This is Chris Evans recording a Storage Unpacked podcast. I'm here with Martin, and another week goes by, Martin, and you are still in the house.
I'm still in the house, but I'm allowed out now. So yeah, I'm okay now. Yeah. Well, I wasn't ill anyway, so
no.
I was being very good.
Safety sake.
Playing by the rules.
Absolutely. Okay, well, that's good news. I'm glad that you know, you're able to get out and do a bit more. So let's move on and talk to our guest of this week. We have Tong Zhang from Scaleflux. Hi, Tong. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Yep, not bad at all. Not bad at all. So we're going to talk to you about a subject that seems to be very popular over the last 12 months.
Yes.
And it sort of falls into two areas. So I think you might call it computational storage. We hear about DPUs and smart NICs and things like that. You know, there's a mix of terms out there.
Yes.
But I think Scaleflux calls it computational storage. So why don't you just take a few seconds and introduce yourself to the listeners, tell them what you do for the company, and then we can get into what you really mean by computational storage in your industry.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm Tong Zhang, the co-founder and the chief scientist of Scaleflux. And also currently I'm a professor at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, or people call it RPI, at Troy, New York State. So Scaleflux was kind of really founded at the end of the 2014 with kind of a mission of exploring the commercialization of computational storage drive. Actually, we coined the term computational storage, and we're very happy to see that it's now gained tremendous momentum in the industry.
Fantastic. I think we'll see CSD in the names of your products at some point. So one would guess that's computational storage drive. I'm guessing that's where the name came from, but I didn't know that you'd invented it as an expression, but that's interesting to know. Oh, and by the way, just as a silly question, how do you manage to find time to develop technology, write papers, and work as a professor at the same time?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So actually, over the years, when I doing research in academia, I have been always kind of have a passion to make what I do practically relevant. So actually, over the years, I have been really closely working with industry. For example, about over 10 years, we collaborated with LSI on one product. It's called LDPC, low density parity check code for hard disk drives. Actually, we are the first one to really contribute to the commercialization of this very powerful error correction coding to be implemented in a commercial chip. So actually, we are very happy to see that our research results really go into the real world. And then around 2013, 2014, I realized that as a solid state drive getting more and more in the mainstream, then we should be prepared for the next innovation wave. And somehow we think this combination of computation and the storage should be the next direction. So yeah, so we formed the team to pursue this direction.
Perfect. So when we talk about computational storage, we've seen, we've seen devices that have had offload of certain functions. We've seen devices that work as storage engines in their own right. We've seen hard drives that will run software that can do things like identifying the data that's sitting on there. So there's a lot of different sort of implementations of this technology. What specifically is Scaleflux doing, and what's your specific sort of view on this?
Yes, really, actually the basic idea of this computational storage is very simple. Actually, it's very naive, right? Once the CMOS technology scaling is slowing down, then the whole industry very natively will look for solution in terms of heterogeneous computing. Then we would just want to use some other computational devices to complement with a host CPU. Then it comes with GPU, smart NIC, or DPU, and then there's a computational storage drive. It's basically different solutions have their own position in the whole landscape. And from Scaleflux perspective, we believe that the storage drive has a very unique position to act as a platform to serve some additional computational function, because that is the drive who hosts all the data. So then along the intuition that to bring the computation closer to the data, then to implement the computation directly on the drive, it is really kind of a no-brainer. So that is our kind of vision along that. So in today's early days, like for as an emerging new product, it is critically important that for the new product to be able to seamlessly fit into the existing hardware infrastructure and the software ecosystem. So that really demand this computational storage drive can carry out the computation with as much transparent as possible to the OS and the user applications.
Okay.
Then, yeah. So that is also one key point that we define and drive our product and the development roadmap.
Okay, so that makes complete sense. Now, we'll dive into specifics of the implementation in a second. I'd just like to sort of get an idea of what we think the challenges are here. And I think this is a good opportunity to bring Martin in just to have his opinion, because some of the things that seem obvious in this market are we always see a desire to increase capacity, to reduce costs, to try and manage the sort of the issues of NAND. So I guess this is an opportunity, Martin, you know, to continue that process at a pace compared to what you could do without having any other technology sitting around that NAND.
Well, it's been relatively easy for people just to continue to focus on capacity, increase capacity. Now the focus is on, obviously, on cost. It's on how we get the most out of this, and also whatever we do needs to be completely seamless. And as Tom says, I mean, it's got to be transparent to the operating system. And this idea of moving computation closer to the data, the storage tier, is becoming very common. And also what I'm seeing in the market and talking to people is we're seeing the way there's a divergence between computational storage and data storage. And what I mean by that, you'll have a big data lake and you'll move your data onto a computational tier to actually deal with. And it's actually how you get the most bang for buck from that. So I think this is what we're beginning to see. We begin to see differentiators between a place where you just put your data to a place where you process your data. And I think this is what we're seeing. Now, we think of it as tiering, Chris, but it's not always. It's not seamless. It's that process. And that's what we're seeing. And then maybe we're going to see APIs go onto the storage to allow you to move these blocks in a particular way, moving chunks of data from one to the other, which it easily. But it, as we say, all these things has to be completely transparent to the application developer, the operating system, to the end user.
Mm. So, Tong, I think that's an interesting angle that Martin's just mentioned there.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, we could just look at the rest of the industry and say, this will be a question for later, actually, but all of the other manufacturers, so, you know, whether it's the chip manufacturers or the drive manufacturers, are just on a timeline to try and increase the capacity, reduce the cost, and obviously keep the endurance safe. But that's great if that's just the data you're storing, but that might not be good enough for that application that needs an extra step of acceleration. And I guess that's where you're coming in to fix an additional problem in this scenario.
Yes. So actually our discussion really kind of further echoes like our thinking. And so then actually that really kind of guide us to define our roadmap, like to be transparent to the OS and the user applications, and also help the industry to solve this kind of latency, like keep increasing the capacity and also maintain the enough life endurance. Then right now, that's exactly what we are doing. That's to bring the transparent compression into the solid state drive. So as the first milestone of this computational storage drive product development, and we have seen really a very great response from the market to our product that is very easy to deploy. And the benefit is very significant, not only from the cost reduction because we transparently compress the data, but also because by reading and writing less data from the raw flash memory chip, we can reduce the latency, tail latency. We can improve the random IOPS. Also we can improve the cycle endurance at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, these seem to be really quite important things, I think, just to make sure that we're clear on this. NAND is a tricky piece of material to manage, yes. and we have to be very careful with it, and it has a limited lifetime. Yes. So if we can do things that reduce the write level on that NAND, it's not necessarily the read that's the issue, it's the write. You've yes. got the opportunity to really increase the endurance of these products, make them last a lot longer and do a lot more. And I think that's the really interesting bit, but it's how you do that specifically. And I think I'd like to go on and just, you know, dig down into the product side of things next. I know that you're on, I guess, what you might call the second generation of your products, the CSD 2000, but there was a CSD 1000 series, I believe, beforehand. So what's the evolution and how what's in the current product compared to what you had before?
Yes, actually, in a nutshell, our current product, or we call the CSD 2000, is an enterprise-grade PCIe solid-state storage device that carries out compression, decompression directly on the I/O path, which is completely transparent to the OS and the user applications. Now, it has a U.2 or AIC form factor, and each drive contains like a terabyte of NAND flash memory, and both TLC and QLC, and a single mid-range Xilinx FPGA that is responsible for both flash control and transparent compression. So that is our current 2000 CSD 2000. So our earlier stage, like previously, we have a CSD 1000. So 1000 really is a kind of we can consider that as a step stone, and to use the FPGA based computational storage card to explore the market. So actually, we implemented like eraser coding and zlib compression, and some few like hashing, those kind of other kind of functions to test the water and to like have the fast like path to really engage with all kind of different customers. So that gave us a very important feedback. So that really helped us to define this CSD 2000.
I think from what you're saying, it sounds, and it makes a lot of sense that compression seems to be a relatively easy sort of no-brainer type approach.
Yes.
Simply because if it's transparent to the user and it doesn't affect the latency of the I/O request and it doesn't affect your throughput,
yes,
in actual fact, it's all win-win.
Yes.
Because, you know, there's nothing to lose there because you're not having to plug any other APIs into anything to achieve that.
Yes.
So, Martin, I mean, that just seems like it is a win-win. Why wouldn't any other vendor be offering this as part of their products natively?
Well, maybe it's a profitability thing. Maybe I want to make money. Maybe I want to sell more NAND. If you've got compression, yes. and you're going to sell less of it. You do talk about compression, Chris, and it's a win-win. It's not always a win-win.
Mm-hmm.
We do need some intelligence in that compression to know when a data stream is already compressed or it's something it can't deal with. Otherwise, yeah, just the act of putting compression in could be bad news and could slow things down if it tries to compress data, which it can't do anything with. We've seen big data get larger, we've seen slowdowns, we've seen all kinds of things come up. So I assume you've got some intelligence built into that data stream and it looks at it and says, you know what, I know it's an MPEG-4 data stream, that's my background media, for instance.
Yes.
I'm not going to do anything with that. I'm sensible enough to know that's coming through pre-compressed. I'm going to have to work really, really hard to get anything else out of it. I'm just not going to bother.
Yes. Indeed, this even though like a compression sounds like a very simple idea, right? Like it appears to be a trivial thing, but how we can practically and reliably implement this transparent compression is really kind of very daunting, like engineering challenges. And also, just echoing what Martin mentioned, that really because before, like if let's say like on the market, like if nobody does transparent compressions, then no flash vendor want to do that, right? So I just want to sell the flash, like sell flash dies, flash chips, right? So, but if one company has demonstrated the feasibility and the benefit, then I'm sure that many people will just follow up very quickly. Actually, it's our belief that in the near future, the transparent compression will be a standard feature.
That makes sense. But I guess also, you know, going back to echoing what Martin just said there, there's, I guess, a combination of two things. There's the fact that there is some data that will not compress very well. and there's some data that will compress very well. And depending on the application, you may well see some very good benefits over and above just raw compression. And I'm guessing that, you know, typically we see compression being applied to things like databases and those sorts of technologies. And if you're offloading that compression function that might have been done at the host layer, then, you know, you're saving cores and you're potentially allowing the host to do more work. So there's a secondary benefit there in terms of something we've talked about a lot of licensing and another labor that the server itself is having to do that you're managing to offload.
So actually, exactly, the database is, well, at least right now, is our major, like a major market. Actually, the majority of our current customers, they are buying our product just for relational database and the NoSQL database. Just exactly as you mentioned, that actually, at one hand, the data in databases, they tend to be highly compressible. Actually, some of our customers even reported like over 5-to-1 compression ratio on their production data. And on the other hand, the database tend to be latency sensitive. So they cannot afford of CPU-based compression, decompression latency on their data paths. So they really like our approach that is transparently bring this compression, decompression without any extra latency on the path.
Okay, so what sort of benefits can a customer see typically with the CSD2000 product? What sort of standard capacities are you selling? What sort of performance are they getting over and above what a traditional device would give?
Yes, so the 2-to-1 compression ratio is a minimum. Actually, it's in database market, in typically on average, the compression ratio is a 2.5 to 3 to 1, this kind of a compression ratio. So that is our baseline. Like usually, when our customer buy our drive, for example, like if the drive has a 4 terabyte physical storage flash capacity, then typically, they will format the drive as an 8 terabyte drive, then to enjoy this at least a 2-to-1 ratio. And if they are confident about their even higher compression ratio, they can even format our drive to like a 10 terabyte or even 16 terabyte.
Okay, so are you required to format it to the size you would like it to be, rather than it just dynamically changing available capacity?
We provide a solution. Actually, our solution enable our customers to dynamically change the total usable capacity. But at the beginning, you have to start from somewhere, right? So at the beginning, you start from based on your ballpark estimation, just an estimate at least I will expect a 2-to-1 ratio. I would format at 8 terabyte. And then later on, if I observe that my data compression ratio is way better than 2-to-1, then we provide this kind of tool set that to allow customers very conveniently to just dynamically increase the drive capacity.
And what sort of impact on environmentals do you see? Does this device need more power than a traditional drive would need? Is it comparable in terms of that?
Yeah, this is a very good question. Our drive just fit into this U.2 bay and with 25 watt limit. So it's a very comparable with the normal drive. Yeah.
Okay. 25 watts would be a lot, I would think, for a single drive. I guess anywhere in operation, an SSD is probably more 9 to 15-ish sort of level, I would have thought, depending on the size and whether it's an AIC. Mm-hmm. So, typical operation, 25 would be top end, wouldn't it? I mean, that would be the slot capacity of that particular PCIe slot rather than necessarily what you're taking.
Oh yeah, sorry, I didn't make it clear. What I meant is that our drive meet this 25 watt requirement, but in the runtime, it really depends upon the workload. If the workload is very, very heavy, we are serving 2 gigabytes, 3 gigabytes of gigabyte per second read traffic, then our drive power might be around 20 watt. But if the activity is normal, then it's certainly down into tens of watt.
It's interesting, Martin. I just thought, from my perspective, I never really expected it, but I know people can't see it on camera at the moment, but I've got, for example, a nice little portable SSD here. This gets really warm when you start writing data to it. Surprisingly so. You wouldn't have thought they'd give off as much heat as they do, but clearly, you know, it takes effort to move electrons around.
It does. Yeah. I mean, it can be quite surprising at times. And if you've ever, or even on something like a consumer digital camera, so if you take the compact flash or the flash out of it after it's been busy writing it, you'll feel the heat off that. Some of that's coming from the camera, but some of that's actually coming from the NAND itself. Yeah, but yes. SSDs do get hot. They got a lot hotter than most people realize.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
So this is important, I guess, Tong, because from your perspective, you want to keep that power base as low as possible to keep your drive as efficient as possible. So yes. You don't want to be introducing anything to the customer's environment that's going to cause a problem from a power perspective.
Yes. So actually, because like right now, our current product use FPGA. So in general, like FPGA tend to consume more power than ASIC. And like later this year, we will introduce our the further generation of product that we will use our ASIC chip. So then over there, then after introducing ASIC chip, then our power consumption will definitely be lower because we consume the same power as a controller on the chip, but also because we write less data to the flash. So then the flash will consume less power. So total, we should be able to reduce the power consumption, especially for the emerging QLC flash. Actually, we are already like burning up our QLC based product. Actually, we have seen very promising and encouraging results by compressing data to help on the QLC in terms of both performance and the endurance and the power.
So do you think that will help you potentially adopt PLC type technology? I mean, we don't know whether that's how widespread that would be, but it doesn't have to be the whole of the drive that's PLC. It could be a section of it, for instance.
Yes.
But if you've got the ability to do some more intelligence around what you do with that data, today you're doing compression, tomorrow you could be doing something else with that, you may be able to add more intelligent features to that drive to manage that data on there. Maybe it's striping to the PLC more efficiently. And it seems to be that compression step one, but the next generation could have other functions in here that use that media a lot more effectively.
Yes. So certainly in addition to the compression, our next step is really combine the compression and encryption together. So then we can just directly on the I/O pass, have a compression and encryption one shot, then without any extra latency. And then beyond the compression and encryption, right now we are already heavily very actively pursuing the direction of big data analytics, because we strongly believe that is the next, I would say, low-hanging fruit. Maybe not that low, but certainly it's low-hanging fruit for big data analytics. We have seen very strong demand in that area, because without analytics, then the data is just garbage, right? Just stay there.
Yeah.
So then you have to reason to get the meaningful things out from those more and more data. But whenever when people do to analyze the data, even people say I'm doing AI and machine learning, data science on data. So actually what I heard is that even now more and more people are acknowledging that is for the normal AI and machine learning and the data science workload, over 80% or 90% of the time and effort was spent on preparing the data, on just getting the useful data out from the ocean of data. Only 10% of the work is really do the real analysis. So, but how efficiently, how quickly we can prepare, we can select the truly useful data. So that is where the computational storage drive can shine. That at the early test bench, we have already done work with Alibaba Cloud along this direction. So we push down the data. We call predicate push down. We migrate the data pre-processing and the pre-filtering function into the drive.
Right. Now, I was just going to sort of say that, drag that into the conversation with Martin there a second and say, how on earth is that going to work? Because one of the things we talked about at the very beginning there of this conversation was that we want transparency in functionality. So when we plug in a device, we don't want to have to go through tons of programming. This bit seems to be slightly more nuanced in the sense that we may yes. have to expose APIs or do something to allow us to get this to work. But we already know we have things like GPU Direct for getting storage to talk to the GPUs. It seems like this could just be an extension of that, but with more intelligence. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's where we're going. We have to expect that some functionality is going to be you can have to address directly. I mean, we're all grown up now. We do know there's general purpose devices where you can just talk to in general purpose. But as you start getting into these more specialized areas, you'll need to be able to talk directly. And not everything's going to be transparent, and we do talk about transparency a lot of time, but you can define transparent as well. So if you're just using an extension of GPU Direct or whatever yes. else comes along, it's still, the developer doesn't care. Just knows he's got those functionality, or that functionality is an offload onto a drive.
Yeah.
It's standards based. As long as it's based on some kind of standard, and we'll say some of these things aren't yet standards because they're owned by particular companies, the same way we talk about S3 being a standard, but to put S3 is not a standard, Amazon could change it whenever they felt like. They'd be mad to do so at the moment, but they can do so.
Yeah, so Tung sounds like there's some work there to just formalize what that interface would be before we get to that point, but it sounds like you're already on the track towards that.
Yes, so certainly for that kind of functionality, we have to bring in some kind of standardized interface to enable this kind of software and hardware interaction. Actually, that is what exactly the NVMe committee is already now currently working on. That is driven by Intel and AWS to really standardize, to extend the NVMe protocol in support of a computational storage drive, to standardize a way that we can specify, and even we can download the code software into the computational storage drive. And also the motivation from the AWS perspective, exactly as along the line of big data analytics. What AWS want to see that they could push down the data pre-processing and the data filtering functions into the computational storage drive. And also, in addition to this kind of standardized interface, because everything will be around NVMe, right? So NVMe will be the king. So we have to expand. So actually, we are very glad, and also we are kind of also contributing, participating in this kind of NVMe committee activities. And also along the way, we are also seeing we can also develop some kind of a turnkey solution. That is, we provide a library, just a kind of a big data library. Then those big data library, just a read and write library, and then we wrap everything underneath the library. The library just expose an open single API to allow the upper level kind of a data analytics engine to push down some predicate, to push down some filtering condition into the library. And then underneath the library, then we can do all kinds of things, and then to partition the task, then to decide which portion could be offloaded to the computational storage drive, which portion should be kept in the CPU. So then if the industry or collectively we can develop this kind of a turnkey library, library-based solution, then to upper-level customers, they still see that as a transparent solution.
Yeah. So, Tung, we spoke to IBM a few weeks ago, and we talked to them about something called MCAS, which was their memory-centric active storage, I think that stood for, and that was using persistent memory to basically build in an API layer, like a set of parameters or calls you could do something with, it, rather than actually have to deal with the specifics of that particular Optane itself. Now, what I'm hearing is probably something similar from what you're saying, except the interesting thing for me is you're talking about a protocol that was originally designed to be a hardware interface between a storage device and a server, now turning into what is almost like a data protocol that is going to be both passing data back and forth, but also potentially exposing the ability to offload computational code that can run on the storage. So NVMe is moving quite significantly forward from what traditional storage protocols would have been like.
Yeah. So really, I think that NVMe is really kind of very ideal vehicle for us to add this kind of support for the computational storage drive. And certainly, I think computational storage will not be, computational memory certainly will be the next, as you mentioned, the IBM, the activity. And also from with my academic hat, I have seen a lot of research papers talking about how we can rethink the memory hierarchy and how we can rethink that the boundary between the CPU and the memory, what kind of computation could be offloaded into DRAM or into NVM. All sorts of things are just popping up in the research community.
Mm. This is really interesting, Martin, as an area, though. I mean, I don't want to say it's making storage interesting again, because storage has always been interesting in certain ways. but what it's doing is it's demonstrating that in order for us to get further forward in just compute in general, we have to look at new approaches that create amalgams of the storage and compute at the same time. And that in itself is really interesting.
Well, I don't think it's just storage, Chris. I think what we're seeing is we can go back to our mainframe days as we like to, Chris. And we're seeing offload engines. This is what these are in many ways, in computational storage or computational memory, but we're offloading work from CPU. And we saw that a lot in the mainframe day with things like vector processing and other processing. This is what we're seeing. We're seeing you have your general purpose CPU, but we're seeing lots of specialized silicon around to do other things, so you can get the most possible out of your CPU. And we've talked about license costs, and if yet again, Chris, it feels like we're going back to the future again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we have to try and avoid always managing to. Maybe we shouldn't avoid always getting a obligatory mainframe reference in every week, but it is true. So this is going to be very interesting to see how it develops, and we'll come back and talk about some other things you can say about futures in a minute. I'd like to talk now just a little bit about who the typical customer is for this particular platform. It's clear that the hyperscalers are significantly interested. You've mentioned two of them just there in the conversation. Is that typically where this is likely to head before it comes to sort of the general enterprise, do you think?
Yes. For our current CSD 2000 product, our major customers are really kind of a hyperscaler, and also including some, actually not only hyperscaler, also web scalers, because they have the highest desire to reduce their cost, to reduce their storage cost, and then also to better utilize their CPU. Then, if they can offload those compression, those computation off from the CPU, then they can release the CPU cycles for their customers. Then over there we see the biggest demand. And also again that from the application perspective, the database NoSQL and also data analytics will be the major driver. And also at the same time, database and data analytics are also the major market for those cloud vendors, right? Cloud for those cloud data centers. Yeah.
Yeah, and I guess typically most improvements that you see in an organization fall into two groups. You're either trying to reduce the cost of a solution, you're trying to be more efficient with it, or you're trying to do something more creative. And it sounds to me like the first stage of what you're talking about for the hyperscalers is they're looking at the cost reduction piece, but at the same time, in parallel, they're investigating let's do something more clever with this piece, which is the AI and the offloading of that side of things. So I guess that's a natural sort of evolution we'd expect is, let's see if we can use it to solve cost issues and so on, efficiency issues. And now once we've done that, let's see whether we can do something more interesting with it. So I guess that's, a standard sort of setup. And do you think the enterprise will pick this up and take it and run with it?
Yeah. Yes. I think there's especially as we are able to really to integrate both the compression and encryption, and then to deliver some solution for the data analytics. Yeah, I'm sure that enterprise customers will, will be very interested. Yeah.
Okay.
And also, I totally agree with your assessment on this evolution, like evolutionary path. So I think really kind of we are still now in the very early stage for this long journey, and we have to be very kind of be really realistic on how much the customer and the market can accept at this stage. So then that really also guided us to start from this completely transparent, like a transparent compression at the starting point to make the start to roll. And then once the customers feel more and more comfortable and then buy in this direction, then we will roll more and more advanced features.
Yeah, and I think, just turning back to you again, Martin, I think this for me is probably one of the most important things, because some of the early solutions we saw at the very beginning of our discussions last year when we were talking to certain companies, one of the first things that leapt out to me was, if you're replacing drives in a server or in a storage array or something like that, most of those are pretty much dumb devices. They see blocks of data. They don't really know what's on there. It may be RAID or erasure coded or striped or some other sort of technique to protect it. And then you look at it and go, well, now you're going to do some compute on that, but you've only got a fraction of the data at that point. You know, even that would be a very difficult solution to put into an existing enterprise or an existing setup. So immediately you're changing what that customer is used to. So we really do need to be looking at this from the transparency side, I think, to see what we can do at that stage before we start looking at other things. And, you know, in your enterprise, I'd imagine you'd look at it and think of that first.
Well, first of all, it's a transparency, as you said. I mean, we've seen this and we know this is what happens. You look at what you've got today, you look what's coming tomorrow, and you try and work out what's coming tomorrow, make it look like what you have today, because you just want to drop it in. And it's important for everybody. It's important because you can't expect an enterprise or a hyperscaler just to rip out their infrastructure and start again. So there's got to be a migration path. So this is the start. We start here, and then we look at it, and then compression's nice. Compression, everybody understands compression. But as you start to add features onto the computational storage device, you then have to start thinking how you're going to use it. The more complex and the more advanced these features are, as we said, they're no longer going to be transparent. They make it special. It is interesting when you start talking things about crystal, things like RAID and data protection techniques. What's going to change there? How's that going to change? Is it going to break? Are we going to have to think about new ways of doing it? If you're doing data analytics or data processing on that, yeah, how do you make sure that everything's consistent? But because let's be honest, Tom, but drives do fail. So when this blows up and you put a new one in, you want some way to be able to rebuild that data. At the moment, we all know how that works, either with erasure coding and RAID. But does this change when we start doing things like computational storage? It's those new frontiers where we have to start looking at and understanding new operational processes, failure domains, etc.
All work in hand, Tom, there, I guess. You just, you know, things you've got to work on and you've got to develop.
Yes. I think exactly. As you mentioned that here, everything will be like a gradual, like a kind of evolutionary. So certainly, I think even for that kind of when we bring in those kind of a more advanced feature, like a more advanced computational task, like the big data analytics, we strongly believe that we have to kind of take a more like a holistic view. To really take into account those kind of rating, like data striping, those kind of issues, take that closely into account, then to reconsider, if I want to, certainly I do not want to force the people to change how they do, eraser coding, right? How they do the striping. I do not want to force people to change that. And I don't believe people are willing to change, from that aspect. So then we have to fit into the existing practice, then to see how we can what we can do to under this condition, under this existing practice, to do kind of a data pre-filtering, like a data pre-processing. We still want to exactly fit into the existing practice. So that certainly we are not claiming that we know all the answers. But we are sure that should be the direction. The whole industry, including us, will do research. I mean, yeah, I'm sure like we have like there are so many smart engineers out there. Like we could always here or there, like we can somehow figure out the solution to move things forward.
To move it forward, yeah. So other than what we talked about already, you know, analytics, encryption, is there anything else you can give us an idea about what might be on the horizon? Sounds like NVMe protocols might need a bit of some work on it. Will you be supporting PCIe 4, for example? What other things can we sort of expect to see?
Yes, certainly the PCIe 4 certainly is a big thing. Like even like a PCIe Gen 5. Actually, for PCIe Gen 4, we're going to support that very soon. And then after that, we will very quickly like roll out the product in support of PCIe Gen 5. And also QLC, and even down the road, the PLC would also be very important, like to show the value of this kind of transparent compression and encryption and in storage analytics. And so what is after? Like what is after data analytics? So that would be the, so I think that would be the very big question to the whole community, to the whole industry. So I think like once we combine the database, NoSQL, and the data analytics, that be already enough for all of us to be very busy for many years. So then meanwhile, I'm sure that the new things will come out, and certainly that will be aligned with the data science and the AI and the machine learning. We strongly believe that computational storage and even computational memory will play a very big role in the future AI and the machine learning. So, actually this data analytics is already a one big part in the AI and the machine learning cycle.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we look forward to seeing in the future what comes up. But for now, if people want to go and check out your technology, where should we point them to? Are there any good resources that you can suggest?
Oh yes, certainly we encourage people to check out our company's website. And also over the recent years, there are many research papers in this area, and many of them are very interesting and worth reading. And also if people are looking for some kind of introductory documents, we highly encourage people to go to SNEAR and the Flash Memory Summit website. And there are many very good introductory documents and the presentations to really kind of introduce this concept of a computational storage drive. What are the problems? What are the research challenges?
Great. I'll make sure I share all of those. That won't be a problem. I'll go and dig out the SNEAR stuff as well. But Tong, for now, thanks. It's been a great conversation. And we're definitely looking forward to catching up with you later on, maybe this year when you bring out the next generation of your products, or sometime in the future when we can hear what the next thing's going to be.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. It's really my honor to be here.
You've been listening to Storage Unpacked. For show notes and more, subscribe at storageunpacked.com. Follow us on Twitter at Storage Unpacked, or join our LinkedIn group by searching for Storage Unpacked Podcast. You can find us on all good podcatchers, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. Thanks for listening.